In the matter of Thomas Stewart and Julie Stewart versus the New Jersey Turnpike Authority et al., may we please have appearances of counsel.
Good morning, Justices. Dawn Atwood on behalf of the New Jersey Turnpike Authority from the law firm of Pashman, Steinwalder & Hayden.
Good morning, Your Honor. Please, Stephen Kessel, Drazen & Warshaw, Red Bank, on behalf of plaintiff appellants Thomas and Julie Stewart.
Good morning, Justices. Faye Sakal from the law firm of Gluck Walrath on behalf of the contractor, Earl Asphalt.
Good morning, Justices. William Rudnick, Gebhardt & Kiefer on behalf of New Jersey League of Municipalities and New Jersey Institute of Local Government Attorneys, amicus curiae.
Good morning and welcome to all counsel. Ms. Atwood, please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could reserve 2 minutes of rebuttal, please.
That's fine.
May it please the court. This case is extremely important to public entities because there's a danger that liability under the Tort Claims Act will be improperly expanded, inconsistent with the legislature's intent. This court's ruling in Polzo, which recognized that intent, would be turned on its head. Rule 446 would be expanded to permit cases to go forward based on speculation. Under the Tort Claims Act and basic negligence principles, the burden of proof would be improperly shifted to defendants to make a prima facie case in the negative. Lay witnesses would be able to speculate and impermissibly be used as experts. The trial court recognized all of those principles and followed them based on the record before it. The material facts of this case, which are undisputed and supported by the record and which were admitted by plaintiffs, are straightforward and simple. Plaintiffs were on a motorcycle together, Mr. Stewart driving and his wife a passenger. They were in a group with two friends, two other motorcycles, including a longtime friend and employee, Jordan Vergara. They were heading north on the Garden State Parkway, riding in the left lane by the Toms River Toll Plaza, which is at milepost 84.7. Mr. Stewart said shortly after passing through the toll plaza, he felt a shimmy due to a flat tire, and that this happened approximately 1 mile from the Route 70 bridge where he crashed. Rather than pull over to his immediate left, where there was a 12-foot-wide shoulder available, he decided to go across all three lanes to the right-hand side, where there was the same size shoulder available. He was going about 40 to 60 miles an hour at the time, and that resulted in the motorcycle doing what he called a death dance or a death wobble twice. Eventually, riding on the rim, the death wobble happened again, and the motorcycle crashed on the bridge deck. Plaintiff admits that he completely lost control of the motorcycle because of the rear tire that was already flat. He further admits that had he not been riding on a flat tire, the accident never would have happened. Both plaintiffs testified that they do not know what happened to ultimately cause the crash and that they relied on what their friend, Mr. Vergara, told them over a month later. Mr. Vergara guessed, and he used the term, "I am guessing," at least 7 times during his deposition, that the metal expansion joint was higher than normal. Yet he never measured it, not even with his finger or a foot. He said, "not at all," his words. Never took photographs, drives that way to work every day, but never went back to look at it. That was never mentioned in any police or EMS report. No expert ever opined on it. And he admitted that he was guessing about it. He could not say at the end of the day how much higher than normal it was. Furthermore, he had no problem getting over that expansion joint, nor did his friend, and plaintiff said if it wasn't for the already flat tire, he wouldn't have had a problem either. Discovery on that issue bore out, and again, these were admitted facts, not in dispute anymore. The expansion joint had been set in concrete back in January, 4 months before the accident. It was completely embedded in concrete between the concrete header and the concrete bridge on both sides and flush with the roadway. There is a photograph to prove this that's in the record. And the roadway was, including the overpass, was inspected before being opened up to traffic. A rideability test was conducted to ensure that all lanes were smooth before opening it up on April 15, 2015, right before the accident. The rideability test is in the record, and the contractor has a specific recollection of conducting that test, and he testified that way. Based on those undisputed facts, we move for summary judgment. Recognizing the shortcoming with the expansion joint theory, plaintiff came up with a brand new theory in response to the motion that maybe a layer of asphalt was missing before the bridge deck. There's no basis in the record for that. No witness testified about that at all. Mr. Vergara even said, his words, "nothing out of the ordinary as to the road surface was visible." It's based on pure speculation, and it's a Hail Mary to try to save the case. The trial court saw that and, in a very thorough and detailed ruling, granted summary judgment. Of course, plaintiff's theory of liability can change during the course of a case, but at the end of the day, the theory that you're left with needs to be supported by actual evidence. You can't turn to speculation at the summary judgment stage simply because your other theories didn't hold water. On appeal, plaintiff then tried to conflate the expansion joint with a missing pavement acclivity. They're two totally different things, two totally different theories, and you can't look at them as one or together. At bottom, the mere happening of an accident does not mean that a dangerous condition existed. Polzo makes that clear. It's longstanding case law. If plaintiff is guessing as to the cause, then a jury would be guessing, which is not permissible. It's not the correct result on general negligence principles, and certainly not the correct result under the more stringent standard of the Tort Claims Act, where immunity is the rule and liability is the exception. If your honors don't have questions, I can move into argument.
Okay. I have a question. Is it your position that under the Tort Claims Act standard, that in order to create a genuine issue of fact over dangerous condition, that there must be an expert produced? Because I'm not sure that I'm hearing that in your argument, and I'd like you to be precise about it.
Sure. Not always does an expert need to be produced, but certainly in this case it would have been, because in this case you're talking about a motorcycle that already had a flat tire, that was wobbling down the highway, and that plaintiff had lost control of already. So you need an expert to say whether something else caused the accident. Here you do need an expert.
If the court agrees that there is no showing of dangerous condition, is there any need for it to engage in any further analysis under the Tort Claims Act?
No, absolutely not, because you must satisfy all four. If plaintiff fails to satisfy one, that's the end of the analysis.
The remainder is unnecessary, correct?
Unnecessary.
Thank you.
Unnecessary.
I thought you would need an expert to determine whether or not roadways are supposed to be built for motorcycle rims, okay, whose tires have been blown out, whether or not roadways have to be safe for someone riding on the rim of his or her wheel.
Your Honor, I think under the Tort Claims Act, the legislative intent behind that act is that a public entity, because it's responsible for so many miles of roadway, that it does not have to be in pristine condition. In fact, this court in Polzo held that, citing Polyard, not every defect or declivity or acclivity in the roadway constitutes a dangerous condition under the Tort Claims Act. And certainly, the legislature does not need to construct a road where a motorcycle riding on a tire rim for a period of time, doing two death wobbles, losing control twice and regaining it the third time, a public entity does not need to construct a road that would prevent an accident from happening after all that, especially not under the Tort Claims Act, probably not under the negligence, basic negligence rules either.
You mentioned a photo in your opening statement, I think the April 30th photo. Can you respond to the argument that there's an inadequate foundation for it?
Yes. So I was actually referring to the January photo, where it shows that the concrete header, that the expansion joint was embedded in the concrete on both sides so that the expansion joint theory could not hold water. That's the photo I was referring to. There was another photo.
I was thinking about the photo with respect to the height differential, the April 30 photo. But if you want to get to that later, you're welcome to.
I can answer that now, Your Honor, of course. Yes, that was another photograph that was produced by the contractor, Earl, in discovery and then produced on summary judgment, during the summary judgment stage. It shows that the expansion joint is flush with the rest of the roadway. And there was also testimony that nothing happened in between the time 3 days before the accident happened, when the rideability test was conducted, and at the time that photograph was taken on April 29th, showing that nothing changed. So that was the condition, the flush flat surface on the date of the accident.
Is that a stipulated fact?
That was a stipulated fact.
When you say nothing changed, there was no additional road work performed by Earl or any other contractor. Is that what you mean?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. And as far as foundation goes, that was produced in discovery, and Earl submitted an affidavit with that photograph explaining why it was taken, when it was taken, and what it showed. And it was taken by Earl. So I don't think there is a problem with authentication. To pick up on what Justice LaVecchia had said, a plaintiff needs to prove all of the elements under the Tort Claims Act. It is the plaintiff's burden of proof, and if one fails, the whole argument fails. Under a dangerous condition, that is a definition that it's intended to be restrictive and demanding, plaintiff has to establish what the supposed condition was, and they can't here, they're guessing. They only have Mr. Vergara's testimony about a metal strip or the expansion joint, which has no dimensions attached to it. Mr. Vergara said nothing about any type of acclivity or missing pavement. In fact, Mr. Vergara specifically said there was nothing out of the ordinary regarding the pavement. And based on counsel's speculation, which was brought up for the first time in response to a it's only based on speculation brought up for the first time in response to a summary judgment motion. And plaintiffs should not be allowed to twist Mr. Vergara's testimony about a protruding metal strip into a missing layer of pavement.
Are you making the argument that that last statement is in essence a sham affidavit?
Yes, Your Honor, under the Shikulski case, yes.
Okay.
It's a self-serving affidavit. It's akin to that.
Ms. Atwood, you do a lot of tort claims work. Is there a tension between Rule 446, which you candidly admitted allows for rather freely for amendment of pleadings as the facts are developed, with the Tort Claims Act's very strict early notice requirement to an entity to detail the nature of the claim and causes? Is there a tension, and how do we reconcile that?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that there is a tension. I think you do have to put a public entity on notice within 90 days as to what your claim is. In this case, the notice of claim isn't in the record. It didn't say anything. The police report was attached, and the police report says nothing about anything with regard to the expansion joint. However, you know, we realize discovery that's why we do discovery, to investigate what the theory is and to see if there's any proof. The plaintiff gets a chance to test the theory and see if there's any proof, and then give that to us so that we can defend against it. That was not done here. There was over 700 days of discovery, 7 discovery extensions, and plaintiff never came forth with anything to prove any of the theories. And especially with respect to some missing pavement, that was way past discovery. And even then, we still came forward with evidence, even though it's not the defendant's burden of proof to prove a negative. We did that. We showed, here's the stuff in the record, here's the rideability test, here are the photographs. We had testimony. There is nothing wrong with that roadway. And that roadway's never been changed since.
Thank you.
Plaintiff, as I said before, not every defect in a highway, even if caused by negligent maintenance, is actionable. That's the Polzo case again. That's no longer true if public entities are to be tasked with somehow keeping a road surface free of dangers unique to motorcycles wobbling down the highway on their tire rims. It would be expanding liability under the Tort Claims Act, which is not the legislative intent. Under the notice provision of the Tort Claims Act, there's been no notice at all to the entity that anything was wrong with this roadway. As the trial court recognized, there were no complaints, there were no prior complaints, no prior accidents, and this is the Garden State Parkway. This is a well-traveled roadway. If something's wrong with that roadway, we're gonna hear about it. We usually do. And there was nothing reported in this case, so there was no notice. Plus, there was a rideability test, and that showed that everything was fine. And to say that we have to show, it's plaintiff's burden, and that burden cannot be shifted. So it fails under that, plaintiff's proofs fail under that prong as well. With respect to proximate cause, plaintiff has not shown that any condition presented any risk to motorists using the roadway with due care in a reasonably foreseeable manner. Plaintiff operated his motorcycle with a tire blown out riding on the rim. There's no dispute that motorcycles operating in the normal course had any issue with the road surface. In this case, specifically, there's no issue that an operational motorcycle had any issue with the bridge deck or the roadway. The inquiry is what, under this prong, is whether the mystery road condition caused a disabled motorcycle already caught in two uncontrollable wobbles with a flat rear tire to crash. And we submit that you need expert testimony on that. That is not a matter within the common knowledge and experience of jurors. And plaintiff never got an expert. All the cases that plaintiff cites with respect to this issue, those cases had experts. And many times under the Tort Claims Act, even the expert testimony, like Polzo, was not enough. The final barrier is whether the entity's conduct was palpably unreasonable under any circumstances. And that's, and the court knows, behavior patently unacceptable under any circumstances. That's a higher standard than ordinary negligence. And again, that is plaintiff's burden of proof. And this court made that clear in the Coyne case recently. Can't say that the existence of an inspection which found everything to be in order is supported by a finding of palpably unreasonable conduct. We are left with a record that at most supports the conclusion that the roadway presented a risk to individuals operating motorcycles with a tire blown out. No reasonable fact finder could conclude that that's enough to establish patently unacceptable conduct. For that reason, this case, even just under this prong, does not need to go to a jury. And again, the court in Polzo, citing Muhammad, makes that clear, that palpably unreasonable conduct, that determination is not necessarily a jury determination. But again, since plaintiff cannot satisfy any one of the elements under the Tort Claims Act, we don't even need to get to that question. Are there any other questions for your honors?
Thank you. We'll have you back for rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Collin, Mr. Rudnick, you've heard the thorough presentation we just got. You're welcome to incorporate arguments to the extent that they match with those you were going to present. Please, Ms. Sakal.
Justices, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
All right.
May it please the court, Petitioner Earl Asphalt does adopt the arguments regarding the Tort Claims Act that were made by Ms. Atwood. We add for this court's consideration that the trial court was correct in granting Earl summary judgment based on its derivative immunity. The application of derivative immunity is a matter of law to be assessed if Tort Claims Act immunity applies to the public entity and the immunity is properly pled as an affirmative defense. Here, the trial court correctly determined that Earl was entitled to derivative immunity due to its performance of the contract with the New Jersey Turnpike Authority, which was directed by the authority, supervised daily by the authority, and approved by the authority as completed per the authority's plan. Also, the authority decided that Earl should reopen the bridge, as Earl did not have the independent ability to do so. This is all evidenced by the consistent deposition testimony of the authority's project engineer, Andrew McConnell, and Earl's project supervisor, Dominic Salsa. The test for derivative immunity in the performance of a public contract is stated consistently in the case law. Rodriguez, Vanchieri, Ornes, and Crystal Ice Bridgeton. One, there has to be a contract, and two, the public contractor needs to perform in accordance with that contract without deviation. This can be shown by establishing that the public entity directed or supervised the performance of the contract, even if supervision were not eyes on, like in Oren. There, the public contractor was found to have performed its contract without deviation under the supervision of the public entity, even though the entity was not on site. The consistent deposition testimony to that effect met the burden of proof for derivative immunity. This is likewise consistent with Rodriguez, a matter involving a security contractor, where both the Sports and Exposition Authority and the contractor agreed that the security company performed in accordance with the authority's plan. In Crystal Ice Bridgeton, there was an excavation demolition company that acted at the verbal direction of a public official in partially tearing down a building. The testimony showed that that order was given, that the excavation company performed it as given, and therefore they were also entitled to the immunity that the public entity received. So if testimony shows that a contractual relationship existed and testimony shows that the public contractor followed that contract to the letter without deviation under the supervision or direction of the public entity, then derivative immunity should be awarded, as it was in this case. Plaintiff relies solely on Vanchieri, in which derivative immunity was not applied to the security contractor. That case is slightly different because in that case, the public entity and the public contractor did not agree as to whether the contract was executed in accordance with the public entity's plan. There was a dispute. There was a dispute contractually whether the public authority of the public entity had exercised any of its rights of supervision and direction under the contract, and therefore derivative immunity could not be determined as a matter of law, and it proceeded to trial. So it's distinguishable, where here we have the public entity and the public contractor testifying consistently that the contractor acted in conformance with the plan, everything was approved by the authority, directed by the authority, supervised daily by the authority, and the bridge was ultimately reopened at the authority's decision. Plaintiff is incorrect also, and the trial court recognized that plans and specifications needed to be submitted in order for Earl to receive derivative immunity. This is not a case where Earl is claiming design and plan immunity. Earl didn't design this overpass. The authority gave it the plans. Earl executed the plans. There is no evidence in the record that there was anything wrong with the design. And this is where plaintiff would have needed an expert. Plaintiff would have had to affirmatively request those plans and specifications in discovery and should have had an expert opine as to whether those plans were inconsistent with standard plans that would, as to the expansion joint, the structural steel, even if we are to entertain for a moment this asphalt acclivity argument, which we claim was not properly made, along with the Turnpike Authority's claim as thus. But even if we were to entertain that for a moment, plaintiff still would have needed an expert to say that such construction was inconsistent with the standard. They do not have that expert. No dangerous condition existed such that the plans and specifications, even if they had been produced on paper, would have been causally linked to this accident. So again, if the authority is immune pursuant to the Tort Claims Act, to the general immunities afforded by the Tort Claims Act, as well as pursuant to its discretionary decision-making, another area of the act, which Earl could likewise get derivative immunity based upon. Earl did not reopen the bridge on its own accord. There was testimony to that effect. Earl reopened the bridge at the authority's direction. If there are no questions about derivative immunity, I'll move on to my next argument. As I stated before, even if this court does not agree that Earl is entitled to derivative immunity, plaintiff still has not met the burden of proof to show general negligence of the contractor. We know this standard of proof. Standard of care, breach, causation, damages. Torts 101. Plaintiff, however, did not present an expert to claim that a construction defect was present at the bridge deck, whether it was the expansion joint, again, this asphalt acclivity argument, which we do not agree is legitimate, but whatever the case, Plaintiff would have needed an expert to establish what is the standard. What is the standard at a bridge deck? What is the standard for an expansion joint? If there were a the expansion joint, we have testimony from Vergara that it was higher than normal. What is normal? If we don't know what normal is, how do we know if it was actually higher? And is normal completely flat, which in this case it was, the photographic evidence shows that. Is normal an inch? Is normal acceptable for a motorcycle with a deflated tire, with an inflated tire? What is normal? We have no expert opining on that. And lay testimony cannot be submitted as expert testimony. You have the case in Wyatt where there was a brake issue, whether a motor vehicle brake was defective. The lay witness saw that there was leaking brake fluid and a worn down brake pad, testified as such at the court. And it was reversible error at the trial level because he could make that testimony as to what he saw, but there needed to be an expert to link what he saw to causation. Here we don't have that. So not only do we not have the standard, the normal, what is normal versus this expansion joint and this overpass, we do not have an expert on causation. We don't have anyone linking a deviation from the standard to this accident. As Ms. Atwood noted, this bike was in distress already. Within about 40 feet, allegedly within 40 feet of the overpass, this bike was in a death dance. Vergara described it as a death wobble at least two times. Plaintiff described he was fighting to not die and to keep the bike upright. We have an expert who opined that riding on this type of deflected tire, riding on a tire rim, no matter what, your bicycle is going down, your motorcycle is going down. We have an accident reconstruction expert who opined likewise that notwithstanding any possible dangerous condition, which again, we deny existed, but notwithstanding any of that, this motorcycle was going down. And we don't have any expert to say that the expansion joint or the overpass in any way disrupted the chain of causation. In 40 feet, going between 40 and 60 miles per hour, changing lanes, fighting a death wobble, trying to not die, how do you show that an expansion joint, that an overpass, contributed in any way to that accident? You need an expert. Plaintiff doesn't have one. Plaintiffs ask that we look at the substantial contributing factor test rather than a but-for test. But the case that he cites is Brown v. United States Stove Company, which is a strict products liability case. In that case, you know, the manufacturer is assumed to have some liability once a defect is determined, and then you need to assess whether an interrupting and intervening cause is sufficient enough to completely obviate that strict liability. That is not the case here. You know, you need an expert to establish that a superseding intervening cause broke the chain of causation. A products liability matter where strict liability is already conferred is irrelevant. The substantial contributing factor test does not apply here. And lastly, I want to note that the plaintiff had relied somewhat on the appellate division's citation to Debonis v. Orange Quarry Company, where the court said that you don't need an expert. A height in the expansion joint is common sense that it would cause an accident or that it could cause an accident or it could contribute to an accident. But that case, the motorcycle tire was not flat. It was not riding on a rim. And additionally, plaintiffs had a liability expert. So it is distinguishable in two very important ways. Do the justices have any questions regarding my arguments on negligence?
No. Anything else you'd like to add?
Not at this time, no. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Rudnick.
Thank you, Justices. We appreciate you allowing us to participate in this matter, and I'll be very brief. Obviously, this is a matter that has great importance to public entities because what the plaintiff is seeking to do is really shift the burden of proof in two important points. One is the dangerous condition itself, and the other is constructive notice. Obviously, counsel for the Turnpike has addressed these issues in detail, so I will not belabor them. But obviously, we see this as an improper shift of that burden, and it really flies in the face of the Tort Claims Act. The Tort Claims Act requires additional elements beyond common law, and it requires a specific proving of the facts based on those elements. And in this case, the arguments would be to essentially ignore what the Tort Claims Act requires. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kessel.
Thank you. May it please the court, you granted leave for the contractor to supplement the record with more legible copies of the appendix, and they gave you in volume three laser copies as opposed to photograph copies of the photographs at issue. This is on 455 and 552 of the appendix volume three. And if you take a look at the photograph and the left side of the concrete between the header and the black asphalt, you can actually see a line that looks like it's a corner between where the side of the header concrete meets the top of the header concrete. This photograph, I think, captures the defect. It was probably taken during the claims process. That transition layer was not down. They had not been able to produce a single person who says out of firsthand knowledge that they know it was down, even though this site was crawling with employees of the contractors and people from the state. They had no one who, they have no records that show that materials were expended to lay that, an asphalt to lay that transition layer down. No records that show the man hours spent. No records showing an inspection done by anybody signing off on to say that this transition layer was down. The only person with firsthand knowledge is Jason Vergara, and he says he saw something sticking up. We didn't know exactly what it was. We thought it was the abutment itself. It was something wrong with the abutment. It looks like it was the absence of a transition layer after we got into discovery. But that's what happens when you have to file a notice of claim within 90 days, and then you have 2 years of discovery. They've been showing this photograph, saying that this is photographic evidence that the transition layer was down. They never laid a foundation for when it was taken. And now that we have a better, clearer copy of it, it does not appear to show what they say it says. Mr. Vergara's testimony is more than enough to create a fact question. This is not a matter of shifting the burden of proof. It's a matter of taking advantage of pointing out that the absence of evidence to contradict the only eyewitness that we have. That's what discovery is about. Both defendants have admitted that this lane should not have been opened without the transition layer down. That kind of gets rid of the need for any experts, for any data as to whether this was a deviation from the standard of care, as to whether it was a dangerous condition. They knew that vehicles were not supposed to be driving over this if that transition layer was not down. The appellate division properly recognized that as a fact question. It's the fact question in this case. There's nothing that's happened that takes that away from the jury at this point. You have a dangerous condition by their own admission that it should not have been opened. It's foreseeable that somebody is going to have a problem whether you have an uneven pavement. Foreseeability does not require that you anticipate the exact happening of the exact accident, but only that you know there's going to be a problem. That it's a more general form of foreseeability. Mr. Vergara draws a connection as between these sort of acclivities and problems with motorcycles. They certainly had notice of what was going on under their very noses, literally. They're supposed to be looking at this. and they missed it. I don't know why. Maybe they were in a rush to reopen the lane. It may have been a bad miscommunication between the contractor and the highway authority, but they opened the lane anyway. And they knew they were not supposed to do that. And the jury will hear their own testimony. We can read it to the jury. We can call their witnesses in our affirmative case. And that's how we can prove it's in a dangerous condition. I'm sure you have questions for me.
Was there any testimony from Vergara or your clients about this acclivity?
They probably misperceived it. There was testimony from Mr. Vergara. He says specifically he saw something sticking up.
I understand. I'm not talking about this piece of steel jutting out.
No.
I'm talking about this acclivity.
The answer is no. No one identified it as an acclivity. It's understandable that after their two friends got wiped out, they're going to have other things in mind.
I'm just asking whether there's any testimony.
No, there is not.
The one witness, mm-hmm, on which you based your Tort Claims Act,
right,
saw some pieces of steel. He didn't see any acclivity, correct?
He saw something sticking up.
Okay. And your client, the stewards, they didn't see any acclivity either,
to which they testified. I think at one point Tommy Stewart said that he thought there was something sticking up a couple of inches, but he wasn't too sure.
I'm talking about the acclivity now. I'm not talking about the steel.
No one identifies an acclivity between the asphalt pavement and the header. No one identifies
that.
So
what is your theory today?
My theory today...
Was the accident caused by this exposed piece of steel or because of the difference in surface levels?
My theory today is that the third layer was not in place of the asphalt. The blacktop was not in place. That no transition layer was in place to step in for it, and that is that accounts for the difference.
Do you need an expert for that testimony, counsel?
I'm sorry.
Do you need an expert to say that asphalt has to be there? Not just your argument to the jury or to the appellate division, in order to say that that's unsafe condition. Because there was no asphalt. Don't you need an expert?
Not only their admission that the lane should not have been reopened without that being in place, they set their own standard of care.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear. You spoke very quickly.
Set their own standard of care because they testified that this lane should not have been opened without that transition layer being in place. Once the standard of care is not in dispute, no one is saying that this lane should have been opened without.
Did they admit that if the transition were not there, that would create an unsafe condition for purposes of the TCA?
No, they obviously didn't admit that.
They said it should have been there.
They say that the lane should not have been opened without that layer in there.
As part of the processes that they go through to finalize
the
construction, right?
Yeah.
So they didn't make any kind of admission with respect to the ultimate issue here with regarding unsafe conditions.
No, there's no admission as to that.
They're saying what we do is the final stage here would be that the transition would be applied.
And that the lane should not have been opened without the transition layer or the third layer in place. And that way they set their own standard of care. An expert can do nothing but regurgitate that.
You're relying on this photograph alone to support your position, correct?
No. I'm relying upon Jason Vergara's eyewitness observation.
And the photograph you claim supports that?
The photograph, the laser copy, shows a height differential between the blacktop and the top of the abutment.
And you're claiming that's what existed at the time of the accident?
It looks like it is. Obviously, we did not have the laser copies. I can't say I showed it to Mr. Vergara and he said that's what I saw, but it shows that there is a height differential there. And Mr. Vergara,
has anybody measured that height differential?
No.
Has anybody opined about that height differential being in violation of any standard?
No.
I didn't want to interrupt your opening statement earlier. Can you focus us on the part of the photo that you believe is critical?
If you allow me to approach, I'll point it out to you.
You can do it from there.
Okay. You will see here that there's a glare coming from there. You will see there is the white concrete between the header, which is this black stripe, and the asphalt, which is on the very bottom of the photograph. If you look at the bottom, if you focus on that white strip and look a little bit above where it meets the asphalt, you will see a line going across the entire length, or width rather, of the that white strip. That white strip is part of the header for the abutment, and it's put in as one piece. That line, I submit to you, may very well have been the corner where the it changes from the vertical to the horizontal. It could have been, it is the edge of the concrete abutment, and that is what probably what
Mr. Don't Ricardo you need saw. Someone to actually say what it is, not what it could have been? And is it, would you agree with me that most roads have expansion joints because of the cold weather and the heat, and they lift up? So assuming that you're right, that was a height, and don't you need an extra say that that's inappropriate? Because most roads, most shoulders have expansion joints. Bridges have pretty large expansion joints, sometimes metal. So don't you need an expert to say that that height, assuming it is what you say it is, first of all, to tell them what it is an unsafe condition, and it's a deviation from the standard of care and or deviation from the construction requirements?
You keep in mind.
You can't, I'm asking you. You can't ask a jury to speculate that that's what caused it, that there was wrong. You need an expert, don't you?
No, I have their admission that the lane should not have been opened.
That's not what I'm asking, whether the lane should have been opened. You're saying that that's what did it.
Yeah.
Don't you need an expert to say that that was improper and that's what did it?
No, we know what it did it because Jason Vergara saw the accident happen exactly as he was going over
but
this.
But didn't Jason Vergara, I'm sorry, can you explain your position that this picture supports Jason Vergara's deposition testimony when he testified that he saw a piece of metal sticking up?
He was mistaken. He saw a difference, something sticking up.
So his testimony, it should be discounted. So you've said he's mistaken.
He's mistaken. He had a split-second observation and got involved in it.
Your only eyewitness who testified to what he saw for the accident was mistaken.
He was mistaken in identifying what it is he saw. He saw something sticking up. He probably thought it was a piece of metal. It's white. It's glistening in the sun. It turns out when we get into discovery, it's this side of the concrete abutment.
Okay. Is the metal piece out of the case?
Correct.
Can I point you to your joint statement of undisputed material facts? Do you have them in front of you?
I can probably find them.
I'm going to read something that you've admitted to, and I want you to try to explain it to me. Tell me if I'm mistaken, because you've admitted number 59. Now, I'm going to read it to you. Maybe you can explain this to me. The asphalt transition at the overpass where plaintiff's accident occurred was in place on April 18, 2015, because if it had not been, the authority in Earl would never have opened up the bridge as standard practice. You admitted that, according to at least what I have here, plaintiff's response to defendant's joint statement of material facts. Okay? You've admitted to that, right?
I don't recall admitting. I'll take Your Honor's word for it.
Well, I have it. It's 521A. That's where your admission is. And the joint statement of undisputed material facts is on 73A. Do you have those?
I'm looking for them.
Because that admission seems to be totally inconsistent with what you're telling us.
If I did, that was a mistake. I see what you're looking at. It's true that as a standard practice, it's probably true, but that was a mistake. If I admitted that, that was a mistake on my part.
Well, we're up at the Supreme Court level right now, and all the other courts have passed based upon an admission to that. And you want to take that back now?
Yeah, I probably misread it when I was opposing it. I am taking it back. I produce enough evidence that it wasn't in place that I thought it created a factual dispute over that because of Jason Vergara's testimony. Obviously,
why should you be bound by that admission?
I should be bound by it. But it doesn't alter the fact that there's a lot of evidence pointing in the other direction. I also pointed out to the court that the what Jason Vergara saw, they saw something different there. There was definitely a height differential. Now, we're trying to figure out what the height differential is, but that doesn't alter the fact that there is a factual dispute over whether there was something problematic with where the asphalt meets the concrete.
There's also an admission as to, in two places, that there was no repair work done, no work performed after the accident, paragraphs 51 and 69. Is it your position the dangerous condition has persisted by admitting to those two paragraphs?
Well, they're referring to repair work. They're not referring to what would have been the normal progress of the plan, which would have been to put that third transition layer there. I'm not saying that right now, if you go down there, you're not going to see that third transition there, that third layer there.
Paragraph 69 says that Earl had not performed any work during April of 2015.
Yeah.
Leading up to the photo.
But at one point, they obviously finished the project and they put that third layer on top of the asphalt. You're not going to go down there and see that third layer missing. This is 4 years after the accident. At the time, they didn't repair it. They didn't come out after the accident and say, hey, we missed this transition layer. Let's put it down now. That's what I understood a repair to mean.
So tell me if I'm trying to understand what 59 means. The asphalt transition occurred. So your adversaries are claiming that the transition layer was already in place on the 18th, at the very least. Am I reading that correctly? Number 59.
Yes, that's what they're saying.
Okay. So at the very least, they haven't conceded that. They're saying it was down, it was flat, it was level.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's just a mistake on my part.
Okay.
So you've really got to rely entirely on the photograph.
No, I'm relying on Jason Vergara's testimony that something was sticking up. The photographs show what it was that was sticking up.
He said metal. You're saying he made a mistake, and then the photo. But what you really are, at the core of what you're arguing, has to be that photograph shows that the third layer of transition was not put down. Otherwise, they have an undisputed situation here that would warrant summary judgment. So you're presenting the photograph to us, but you don't have an expert to interpret for the trial court and ultimately to the appellate court what is being seen on that photograph.
I don't have an expert, obviously. I have Mr. Vergara seeing something in discovery.
You have Mr. Vergara saying something, and I understand the strategy. You're backing off your reliance on what he actually said, but you have to characterize that by saying it really was a mistake on his part. He really was seeing a differential in height, not a metal piece.
That's correct.
And that's a pretty thin read, is it not?
Well, it's life.
I'm sorry?
It's life. This is how life works. An accident happened in a split second. He gave us his best recollection of what he saw. We get into discovery and the more, dispassionate view of discovery, and we realize that what he thought he saw wasn't what he actually saw. That's just the reality of what accidents happen.
Can I ask you a couple questions about that, just to clarify? Let me start with the photograph. Is this the April photograph?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
When was the photograph you're relying on today? When was that taken?
I don't know. They've never given us the foundation. It was taken by someone on behalf of one of the defendants.
Is it? It's in the appendix.
It is. The photograph I'm relying on is in the appendix that was given to this court, not to the appellate division or the law division.
Okay, I understand. Is that? And they. talked about, identified. Is it the January photograph you're relying on or the April photograph?
The April photo. I understand it to be the April photograph that was taken by someone on behalf of the defendants.
And you have no basis to dispute that?
I'm sorry?
You have no basis to dispute that?
The photograph shows what it shows.
Okay, that's what I'm interested in. Just so I can clarify. At the bottom of the photograph is black, correct?
Right.
That's asphalt, is it? And then there's white, that's concrete.
Right.
Then there's a black line. Is that the line you're referring to?
The black line, the thick one, the very thick one.
No, the one at the very bottom, is that the thick black line?
The one at the very bottom I think it's a corner between the...
Is that the line you're referring to?
No.
Okay. Then there's the white concrete.
Yes.
And then there is a black line. Is that the line you're referring to?
No.
Okay. You're relying on what? The right side of the photograph?
No. If you look between those, if you look between the asphalt and the header, a little bit above, maybe a fifth of the way above the bottom.
Turn the page around as you do
right.
Just so that we can see what you're pointing.
This is the asphalt blacktop, okay? Right. This is the header. I'm talking about this white area between the two of them. If you look very carefully, about 20% of the way between this and this, you will see a very thin line going in the width of the photograph, okay? It looks to me that's a corner.
Is there a fact witness that describes this, someone with firsthand knowledge?
No.
Put aside an expert. Okay.
No. We never got this photograph until the case was already in the Supreme Court, so it was not part of discovery.
Can you explain to me one other admission? I'm trying to understand it. It's number 57. You've admitted to that. I'm just going to read it. The expansion joint had been cast into the concrete header and bridge deck for several months prior to plaintiff's accident and was flat with respect to the surface.
Right.
So that would suggest that there wasn't anything protruding, no?
Correct. Nothing protruding from the expansion joint. So that's why Mr. Vergara was probably wrong when he thought it was a piece of metal sticking up.
Okay. Really? So to be clear, that the piece of metal, as you have answered questions, is out of the picture, and you're solely relying upon this elevation.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so let me get back to this for one second. This, what the black at the bottom, the asphalt, the white, that's the concrete, and then there is the joint.
Right.
Okay. You are saying this is the photograph that shows the discrepancy that Mr. Vergara observed, correct?
Yes, it does.
And everybody agrees there was no work done on this place, this location, since the accident, correct?
There was no repair work done after the accident.
Okay. You have had how many years since the accident?
Four, five at this point.
And during those 4 or 5 years, 700 days of discovery, plus more than 700 days. Is that right?
I'm sorry, I missed.
You've had more than 700 days of discovery, correct? There were 7 discovery extensions, correct? And during those 4 or 5 years, did anybody, having had this photograph, or frankly, not having it, did anybody go out there and observe this black line you're talking about, measure it, and render an opinion about whether it is in fact a height discrepancy, and if so, how much?
We assumed that the third layer, we understood that the third layer had, the permanent third layer had been put into place, and that...
Well, we know there's been no repair work since the day of the accident, so it wasn't put in since the day of the accident.
Well, it had to be. Otherwise,
okay, I understand. Did anybody, since the day of this accident, having now looked at this photo, go out there, observe a discrepancy or not, and measure it?
No, but we only got the photograph back in April.
Is there, April of this year.
Right.
Is there any, in the record, there's the contract, there are the specs, and there are the work orders, correct?
Right.
Is there a work order, as I understand there was, for that last layer of asphalt that you claim was not there on the day of the accident?
I haven't seen it. But, you know, the work would not have been done without that permanent third layer being put into place. So we assumed that by the time we could get an expert out there, the work had been finished, which is our understanding.
But you can see there was no work done after the accident. So why would you then believe that the work had been done, since you yourself admit that no work was done to fix, repair, or change anything where the accident took place after the accident? So why would you assume that someone worked on it afterwards?
I can see there's no repair work done. I did not concede that the project had not been finished with the application of the permanent third layer.
So even if we, let's assume everything you're telling us right now. The definition of dangerous condition is a condition of property that creates a substantial risk of injury when such property is used with due care in a manner in which it is reasonably foreseeable that it will be used. How do you go forward without an expert on that? Particularly since your client is riding a motorcycle on its rim, not on the tire, on its rim. Without an expert, how can you proceed?
Because what's an expert going to say except that someone riding on a motorcycle is going to have to get over to the side of the road?
Well, an expert might say that, you know, roadways are built for certain conditions, and they may assume that tires are inflated or could be deflated, but like no roadway of this type, it can be built to account for a motorcycle riding on its rim.
Well, there's nothing unforeseeable.
Well, that might be their expert. Your expert would have to be countering that.
There is nothing, it's foreseeable that motorcycles are going to get flat tires. It's nothing unusual about that. Vehicles get flat tires on roadways. They've been doing that for a century. There's nothing unforeseeable about that. It's still a foreseeable use of the roadway when you get a flat tire to try to angle over to your right and get off the roadway. What's the expert going to testify to other than, it's foreseeable that this is going to happen?
We'll never know since you didn't get an expert. So we don't know what he's going to. We don't know what he would testify to. But he certainly wouldn't testify that highways have to be 100% accident-proof. There's no such standard.
No, but he would testify to what we already know, which is that this lane should not have been open unless that transition there was in place.
But in fact, he didn't. That's your...
Well, that's a factual dispute.
No, it's not a factual dispute. There's no expert to dispute the facts with. You're not testifying in the case. You're simply the attorney. So you're testifying as an expert would, but that doesn't count.
They've admitted that the lane should not have been opened, but if that transition there was not in place. It's not in dispute. It's their standard that they set for themselves.
Where in the record is the fact of the height differential?
I'm sorry.
Where in the record is it a fact that there was a differential in the height, the theory on which you're relying? Where is the underlying factual support for that? Is it simply the photo?
Yes. The only thing in the record is that something was sticking up that Mr. Vergara saw, which he misinterpreted. That's the only thing that's in the record. Beyond that, the only thing in the record is this photograph.
And just to be clear, we understand that you objected to this photo, the black and white, and said that it lacked a foundation, that it reflected the condition of the premises on the day of the accident.
Correct.
You no longer stand by that objection with respect to the laser photo?
No, I don't. I still object. We don't know when that photograph was taken. It was just not in the record. It's a representation by counsel that their experts took it at some point later on. We don't know if it was taken, at what point in the process it was taken.
What's in the record about the laser photo you were showing us?
The only thing in the record about the laser photograph is that they replaced the photocopy in their appendix with this laser copy.
So my question is a simple one. You were asking the court not to rely on this for the reasons that I read, but you are asking us to rely on the laser photo, correct?
They are relying upon the photograph to show that there was no difference in elevation along that portion of the roadway. Okay, this is They're asking for summary judgment, saying there's no factual dispute because the photograph shows that. I'm saying the photograph doesn't show what they say it does, and therefore there is still a factual dispute as to what Mr. Vergara saw, and that this photograph is the most likely explanation of it.
What are you saying? There's nothing in the record to indicate what the height differential is? Assuming that there is one, is there anything to indicate what that height differential is, whether it's a quarter of an inch, a half an inch, 2 inches?
The testimony from the defense witnesses was that that third layer would have been 2 inches high. And if the third layer was not there, it's a fair inference that the height differential would have been those 2 inches that they would have left room for between the second layer and the top.
Have you established when the third layer was put down?
No.
You don't know?
I don't know. I know it wasn't there at the time. I think it's an admitted fact.
Are you, in effect, asking us to look at the laser photo, make our own determination,
no,
and proceed on that basis?
I'm asking you to realize that to get summary judgment, they have to show the absence of a material fact. I raised that fact by Mr. Vergara's testimony. They're saying it's not enough. I'm asking that you look at the photograph to show that the primary evidence they presented to the trial court, that there was no disputed facts, doesn't show what they say it shows. And therefore, they have not sustained their burden of eliminating a factual dispute as to Mr. Vergara's testimony that something was sticking up.
And we're supposed to do that based upon visually looking at this photograph and making an interpretation of what is going on in that photograph without any assistance by someone who understands construction of bridges and roads.
I would ask that you make that you draw that conclusion from the absence of any foundation that this photograph shows the condition of the roadway on the day of the accident. Previously, I had relied upon the fact that we don't know when the photograph was taken, and now I'm also pointing out that it doesn't show what they...
But, counsel, in your stipulated facts, paragraphs 64 and 65, which are admitted by you, have the defense witness saying multiple times that there was no 2-inch lip between the asphalt and the bridge deck. So you're asking us to assume or infer from that photograph a fact that's contradicted in a sworn, jointly agreed to statement of fact. How do we do that?
I'm sorry, what paragraphs were you referring?
64 and 65. 64
and 65. I'm not quite sure I'm on the same page as you are.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. You, in your answer, you denied those, so I apologize. I didn't mean to add to the confusion.
Counsel, would you like to move on to the derivative immunity argument?
Well...
And you're welcome to stay on this point if there's additional argument you'd like to present on it.
I'll answer any questions you have, but I think we've asked them all. Okay. Derivative immunity isn't automatic. They have to prove that the instructions they received from the public entity are themselves immunized, and they get that immunity from that. They have never pointed to an instruction they received from the Turnpike Authority that this is an immunized decision and we had no choice but to follow it. And in the absence of that, they just haven't sustained their burden on that affirmative defense.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
No.
Thank you. Ms. Atwood?
Thank you, Justices. Just briefly, with respect to the photo, it was produced in discovery by way of a notice to produce from Earl. The photo was, and in the notice to produce, it was specified that the photo was taken on April 30th of 2015. There is a certification with the notice to produce from Dominic Salsa, who is the, I think he's the owner of Earl Asphalt. And because this photograph was produced in the laser copy, was produced back then, this is not the first time we're producing it, it was just to supplement the appendix because only a poorer quality copy was produced to the court, but that was produced way before depositions were taken, and that photograph was never used by plaintiff's counsel at anybody's deposition.
May I ask you to clarify, and I think you just said this, I want to make sure. The black and white and laser photos were both produced at the same time?
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. The laser photograph was produced with the notice to produce during discovery before depositions were taken.
Was the black and white a copy of that that just didn't have the same level of quality because it was black and white? And
yes, Your Honor. Color. Yes.
So this is the laser copied over with a usual copying machine. Is that?
I imagine so.
Okay. I'm looking at 552A, and there's a second photo that looks very similar, 455A.
Yes, and Your Honor, I believe that's why Earl supplemented the record, because plaintiff had produced the black and white copies with the appendix.
So this is not a new photograph that appeared in April of 2021?
Correct, Your Honor. This is not new at all, and it could have and should have been used at Mr. Vergara's deposition. Could have just asked him, is this what you were talking about? Because you said a shiny metal object sticking up. Maybe did you mean this? Nobody did that. It could have been asked at any of Earl's, at the Earl deposition, at the Turnpike's deposition, at plaintiff's deposition. It was never used. The first time we're hearing this argument, and it seems to be a pattern in this case, is right now at the Supreme Court level when there's nothing left to... There's just nothing left for the plaintiff, I think.
Counsel, you heard me reference Admission 59, which your adversary now is withdrawing. Is there anything in the record to indicate when the asphalt transition was laid?
It was laid in May of 2015. That is in the record.
2015?
Yes, after the act. It was this... I believe that's correct.
Okay, so tell us what that means. Does that mean that there would have been a differential in the roadway before that was laid?
No, it does not mean that at all. In fact, the authority and Earl both testified that there was no differential in the roadway. There would not have been a differential in the roadway because what happens is the transitional layer, you just add more to that layer so that it comes up flush with the bridge deck. The rideability test is part of that whole thing, that everything is smooth, that there are no obstructions in the roadway, and that test was conducted and passed.
Okay, so your position is on April 18th, the roadway was flat?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, and there was testimony in the record about that. In fact, Earl had a specific recollection. And as Your Honor's picked up on, Mr. Vergara never said anything about the pavement. In fact, he said the pavement was fine, and I have the deposition reference if anyone would like it. He said it was a piece of metal.
Let me just see if I understand. So the admissions that were being discussed with your adversary, which, and I don't have it in front of me, but essentially that without the final transition layer, the road would not have been reopened. Is that the essence of that admission?
Yes, they testified that without the final layer, I'm sorry, Your Honor, without the roadway being smooth, the final layer is going to be added later.
There's no disagreement. The final layer had not been added at the time of the accident, but the admission that was being discussed here is about the layer prior to the final layer?
Yes, it's about the roadway being flush with the bridge deck.
Okay.
That's the asphalt transition? I'm following up on Justice Patterson's question, just to be clear about this. Is that second layer the asphalt transition? Yes? I'm looking at 59. The asphalt transition at the overpass where plaintiff's accident occurred was in place on April 18th. Of course, if it had not been, the authority and Earl would never have opened up the bridge as standard practice. So tell us what the asphalt transition is.
Yes, it's a layer that is there before the final layer is put on. But it's not that the that transitional layer is there, and then there's a space. The transitional layer, more asphalt is poured into the transitional layer. For example, if it's 2 inches, but the bridge deck is another 2 inches, then 2 more inches will be poured for the intermediary layer to reach up to the bridge deck, so you'll have 4 inches. When they go back to do the final layer, they will mill back that extra 2 inches and put the final layer in its place.
Is that what happened here? Is that why we don't have an increased height when the May 15th asphalt transition is laid? They milled back some of what was on the roadway and replaced it with a final layer?
If they had to pour extra transitional layer, that's what would have happened.
So explain this.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yes. In May, they would have milled back part of the top layer and put on the final wearing surface.
But that final wearing surface is not the asphalt transition layer?
Correct. That goes on of the transitional layer, the intermediary layer.
So the asphalt transition layer did not go on in May of 2015, as you just said. It went on before that.
The transitional layer was on at the time of the accident.
You said 2 minutes ago.
Oh, did I?
2 minutes ago. The asphalt transition layer, now I'm really confused, went on in May of 2015, which is after the accident. Is that correct?
No, the final surface layer.
Okay, so the asphalt transition layer was in place on the day of the accident.
Yes, Your Honor.
And this milling back and putting back on of the final layer is in May of 2015.
Yes, Your Honor.
And this photograph dated April 30th is of the road surface with the final transition layer.
No, Your Honor. The April photograph shows what the roadway looked like before the final surface went on, and it's to show that it was smooth, that the transition layer still went right.
I think there may be some confusion, Counselor. Perhaps when the road's laid, the asphalt's put down, and the transitional layer is what makes it go up to the bridge height.
Yeah.
That's not the final layer, because that wears out quickly and it's somewhat rough. Then after that, pavement settles, or the blacktop, and everything's tight, and they steamroll it. Then they come in with the final layer, and because the final layer is usually 2 inches thick, they mill down any areas that would make a bump or a dip in a road. So you're talking about the final wear layer, and we seem to be talking about the transitional layer, which is beforehand. Is that pretty much how it's done?
Yes, Your Honor.
Unfortunately, that's not my question. The picture, April 30th picture, April 29th picture, does that show the asphalt transition layer, or does that show that final finishing layer done in May of 2015?
That shows the transitional layer.
Okay. That final finishing layer is not in that picture.
No, but
So let me ask. Okay.
Correct.
But you're saying that shows the condition at the time of the accident.
Yes.
And what you're telling us is that the photograph shows that there was no height discrepancy that's not a technically correct word, between the two surfaces. And what happened later was the application of the final layer, which doesn't matter for purposes of this case because that was after the accident, but would not end up with a 2 inches higher height differential at that point, because they would mill it down and then build it back up with the surface layer.
Exactly, Your Honor.
I know I'm probably mangling the technical terms.
Is there any difference in the height between the asphalt transitional layer and the final transition layer?
No, there is not. The reason why the April 29th photograph was produced was to show that, was to make that point. And in fact, we also in the record are photographs from Steve Emelo, who is our expert, who has pictures taken 3 years later showing the final wearing course. It looks the same as this April 29th, 2015 photo. Nothing's changed.
But I want to make sure we're looking at the right photo. Paragraph 60 of the Undisputed Facts talks about April 30 photos, dated April 30, taken by an Earl representative. Is there a different set of photos for April 29th, or is that just...
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to correct Justice Solomon before. It is April 30th, not the 29th.
Whatever. That was no one ever tries to correct him.
You're forgiven.
Thank you, Justice.
Is there anything you'd like to add?
All I wanted to add is that plaintiff says first that Mr. Vergara's testimony is more than enough. But that wasn't his testimony, as your honors pointed out. And then later on, he says that, you know, Mr. Vergara was mistaken. I mean, you can't have it both ways, trying to fit a theory, you know, into this case. At the end, we're left with speculation. Now we have counsel explaining what a photograph shows, just to dispute what was already undisputed in the record before of what the photograph shows. And clearly you need an expert for that if you're going to talk about some dangerous condition in a photograph. But I merely wanted to point out that the photograph was produced and was available and was just never used. So now is not the time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justice.
Do you want to offer rebuttal? I see you do.
Just briefly, Justices, if anything, the conversation that just ensued shows that an expert is necessary in this type of case. None of us as attorneys can stand up to a jury and say how asphalt should be properly laid.
You're not prepared to accept Justice Fernandez-Vina's description?
I would love it if the justice would do
so. Is that the way it's done? First, you grade it.
You don't have to answer that.
Jesse, that's the way it's done.
Well, the project manager, Dominic Salsa, Andrew McConnell, they are engineers for our respective clients, and they certainly understand how it's done. But respectfully, plaintiff's counsel can't testify as to how it was done or done incorrectly. The transition layer was in place. Mr. Salsa, Mr. McConnell both testified to that effect. I also do have the record from when there was milling and paving for that final layer that is in the appendix at 352A on May 27th. They had to mill back the transition layer.
You do have a record that indicates there was milling.
Correct.
Which means the height was reduced and Correct. Then restored.
Does the milling matter for purposes of this argument?
It does not. It just, I want to establish there was a transition layer in place that had to be peeled back in order for the final layer to be put down.
What you're trying to do is counter any inference that prior to that last stage in May, there was a height differential that had to be corrected.
That is correct.
And there was a work order for that transition. That final transition layer, was there not?
The work order for the final transition, it wouldn't have said transition layer, it would have said pave, because that is essentially what it is. The nuance of the language isn't something that the contractor needs to produce to the Turnpike Authority. Everyone knows what paving is and why it happens.
That work order was produced.
It was not produced. It was something that occurred in March. There was no work that occurred in April. And April were the records that were requested. But I think that the photograph demonstrates that there is no lip in that transition layer. We did produce all the work orders from Earl in April. None pertained to the northbound parkway in the area of this accident. So whatever existed at the end of March, whatever existed with regard to that asphalt is as it appears on April 30th in that photo. Whether plaintiff's counsel can point to a line that he thinks looks a quarter inch, 2 inches, we have no idea what it's supposed to show. And he doesn't have an expert to say what it shows or what it shows in comparison to any other asphalt abutment to concrete anywhere in the state. We don't have a standard. Plaintiff's
counsel.
Would
that also be an expansion joint by any chance?
Excuse me?
Would that also be an expansion joint, what the photograph is of?
The expansion joint is in the photograph. It is the two. So you see the asphalt.
Right. Yep.
Yep, it is there. It's the two black lines. There's a rubber membrane in between. And as you'll see, the other photograph, I believe, is January 15th, 2015. That is when the expansion joint, it's part of the structural steel of the bridge. And that's when it was put in as part of that steel. You can see the concrete header, then the two pieces of expansion joint, and then the concrete bridge deck. So there should be no dispute whatsoever that the expansion joint itself was flat and flush. We have two photographs depicting that, one from when it was built in January 2015 and one from April 30th, 2015, after we also have established no work was done on the expansion joint during that time frame. I mean, it would be pretty clear if work had been done because this is structural steel. To fix that expansion joint at any time, they would have had to essentially demolish the bridge they had erected. So I guess the crux of the argument here is we don't
know. Let me just ask you something for clarification. Is the expansion joint only relevant to plaintiff's case based on their metal piece theory?
Correct.
Okay, so the expansion joint, we now confirm, is no longer of any relevance.
And we would argue, and I think we have argued, that there were 700 days of discovery focused on an expansion joint. It wasn't until the opposition...
I'm sure you never got tired of that.
Oh, it was wonderful. You're wonderful, Justice. 700 days of discovery talking just about a metal strip from the beginning. Metal strip, metal strip, metal strip. And that was solely based on Vergara's testimony, by the way. Plaintiff does not independently recollect an expansion joint, nor does his wife. No, there's nothing in the police report. It's solely Vergara saying over and over again, metal strip.
So you're saying that the photograph shows that the expansion joint was embedded and was certainly not protruding from the surface, but that's out, right?
That does not
support in any way the height differential theory.
The height differential theory regarding the concrete and asphalt, no. The photographs, the April 30th photograph, I believe, does show it's flat and flush. My client, Dominic Salsa, he certified that that is what the bridge deck looked like on the date of the accident because no work had been completed. And my opinion on whether or not it looks flat and flush in the photo doesn't matter, and nor does Mr. Kessel's. And that is why an expert is needed to look at that photograph and say, it is flat and flush, it's not flat and flush. That is why deposition testimony is needed by an expert, by engineers, such as Mr. Salsa, such as Mr. McConnell, to say it was flat and flush, or, which we dispute, it wasn't flat and flush. You know, attorneys are not witnesses. We're not here to allow the jury to speculate based on what we think something shows. And at this point, we don't believe plaintiff has made enough of a showing of proof to get before a jury.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement. Court's